This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Improve your development skills by completing coding exercises that are peer-reviewed by real humans. Learn more at upcase.com.
Giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with Karen Meyer. Hey, Karen.
Hi.
I'm curious how about your path. Your bio reads very interestingly. You started off as a professional ballet dancer and then studied physics and then ended up as a software developer.
Yeah, it was a surprise. So growing up, I attended the School for Creative and Performing Arts mm-hmm. in Cincinnati and was big into ballet. The term that they call us were bun heads.
Huh. Oh, yeah, right.
With our hair in buns. The thought of doing computer programming or anything else than ballet was kind of out of my head. I just wanted to do ballet. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough, actually, to audition and work professionally for a small ballet company in Memphis for a couple of years right after I graduated. Mm-hmm. And that was very good. But at the end of a couple of years, I started reevaluating my life as I was living on mattresses and eating ramen noodles. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the best career choice. So I decided to go back to college. Mm-hmm. And I chose physics for two reasons. One, because I kind of like to know how things work. You know, that's very appealing. And I liked math. But I also had a really inspirational physics teacher in high school that was a woman. And from that point, role models, I think, have impacted my life very positively. Because I don't know whether I had, when I was sitting down trying to decide which way to go, if I hadn't had her as a role model, I don't know if I would have gone that way.
Yeah, totally.
So then after physics, I graduated physics. I really love physics. I was thinking about going on, but I didn't really want to do the whole PhD thing. Mm-hmm. And at the time when you graduate with a bachelor's in physics, there really isn't much for you to do.
Yeah, right.
So luckily this new computer science stuff was going on. There were lots of programming jobs and people looking for it. So I just kind of got sucked into it. I did a little of programming in college with Mathematica mm-hmm. and doing some modeling. And I really liked that and just kind of grew into it. So now I love what I'm doing. So
how did you get that first job with the physics background, like having done not much programming already?
It was on college recruiting with a consulting firm. Okay. And they're like, you got a bachelor's in science, you can program.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Come on in.
Which turned out to be true.
So
it worked.
So it worked for me.
Yeah. As you were talking about the ballet stuff, I was reminded, like, it feels like a shame to me how difficult arts careers are.
Yeah.
Like, I sing myself and have a number of friends that are professional singers, and it's just such a hard gig. And like the friends I have that are professional singers are like already in like the 1% of the 1% of people that can make a living doing some sort of arts thing, and they're still struggling. It's still hard. It's just still a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, it is. And you obviously end up doing it for the love of it.
Of course. Yeah.
Definitely not the money.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is possibility of making money if you really hit it big. But it's not like if you're a football player and you hit it big. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a bigger payoff, I guess.
Right. Totally.
Well, I don't know. Maybe professional singers. I mean, if you're a pop star, you know.
Yeah, right. Exactly. At the very, very end of that spectrum.
Exactly.
But still, it's a shame. I wish it was easier to have a career like that. Like, because there's a lot of good that can come out of, you know, things in the arts that way. So
yeah.
it's a shame. It's so hard.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of people that have come into computer programming, though, from the arts background. Like, I know a lot of people that have come in from the music background in particular.
Totally. I was actually going to ask you about that. Like, I noticed the same thing. Music in particular, there's a lot of music in our field, and I'm not sure why that is, but I'm curious if you have any guesses.
I don't know. I personally don't know how to read music. That's horrible. I wish I had learned, but I mm-hmm. never did. But if I had a guess, which is just a wide guess, it would be having something with like languages. There's a finite number of parts. There's notes that you compose and form in different ways, and you have rules in which you can make them work. And I think that's a lot like programming languages.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, could be. So you are writing a book.
I am. Actually, I just got an email yesterday that it went to production.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Well, I know. I'm so excited. So I'm actually might actually have a real book in my hands in like a few weeks.
So going to production in the book world means something different than our going to production, but also means the same thing.
Yeah. So the process of writing a book, I'd never done it before, obviously. So I had no idea what goes into it. So there's definitely the writing phase. You write a chapter and then your editor kind of looks at it and then you rewrite it.
Right, of course.
And then you write chapter two and then you rewrite chapter two and chapter one. And you just kind of go along that the whole way. And so that's
sounds part like programming, of the, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a pretty long process to get written, and then it goes through some proofing after all the technical reviews and the feedback, then actually goes to professional proofers. And it's amazing how I don't know grammar. This is what I discovered.
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw all the corrections. I'm like, oh man, I should really look into. I hope that my writing skills have increased through this process, but still, there was a lot of red.
Yeah, a good friend of mine wrote a book recently and went through a similar process and said by the end he felt like he was writing at just a much much higher level, like his writing had tightened up a lot. Did you experience that?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a lot more conscious of now when I'm writing blog posts or articles, of just, you know, keeping the reader more in mind and things that make easier transitions for the reader.
Interesting. So like mental transitions, like tying sections together, you mean?
Well, mental transitions between sections and kind of having a structure to lead somebody through an idea and not have them jump around too much.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's interesting. A coworker of mine is almost finished writing a book about Haskell, and I did a lot of editing for it. And that was actually a lot of the things that I suggested was, you know, can you tie this back? Like, can you make this thing relate to this thing more? Can you like pull this example from this section back again and talk about it again, or like keep referring to the same thing? Because you're right. When it's sort of just now we're talking about a new thing, it's like if it's totally new and unrelated to the things before, you've lost context and you have to start from scratch.
Yeah. It's totally, it is a different skill set. So I totally respect the other people that have written books and that are really good at it, because it is a different skill set.
Yeah, I'm sure you have a new appreciation for it now.
Oh, yes.
So are you done with active writing then? So production means they're actually like printing it on paper, right?
Yes, they're actually printing it on paper.
Okay.
So yes, I'm done.
You're done. So do you feel like $1 million?
I feel like a weight is kind of lifted off.
Yeah.
So yes.
Has it been replaced by like, I hope everyone likes this book?
Yes. I mean, I hope that it's useful for people. I've gotten some good positive feedback that people have seemed to like it. So hopefully it'll be useful for people and make it easier to bring new people into the closure world.
Uh-huh. So I know there's something that seems, at least to me, unique about this book, which is the second half of it is a structured set of daily exercises.
Yeah.
It's like a 7-week program to kind of get you into functional programming. I think that's such a cool angle.
Yeah. So this was brought about when I was trying to run.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always been one of those people that, you know, people around me are running and I was like, I can't run. You know, I hate running. I'm just, my body's not made for running. I had a million excuses of why I couldn't run.
Yep.
And I would try it every now and then, and it would just reinforce the idea that I couldn't run because I would be in pain and out of breath.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ran into this program. It was called Ease Into 4K, 5K.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of other running programs take a similar approach. But it just had structured plans. So it started out, you just run a little bit and walk a little bit the first day. And then you build up and you do this over a course of, I think it's like 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like this huge weight lifted off of me. Like I didn't have to do it all at once.
Right.
And that was the reason why I was failing. So when I actually just did it a little bit at a time and gave my body a chance to accustom it, I could actually get through and run at the end of it, which I thought was incredible. And as I was doing this at the same time, this is kind of what ties it in. we were discussing with a group of programmers, other people, they kind of know that I'm into closure and I love closure.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to learn it. And they said, I just don't know. I don't think my brain's made to do closure and I can't do it. I said, well, how did you try it? You know, I'm interested in what you were doing, how you were learning this. Oh, I picked up a book and tried to do it all over the weekend.
Right.
And I just didn't feel like I could get it. I'm like, well, that's the same thing I was doing with running. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot longer, especially if I think if you're coming from an object-oriented background, right. It is a different way of thinking, and you do need to give your brain a chance to adjust to it.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. It's so interesting. I feel like there's a skill that we kind of lose as we age, which is being comfortable with being bad at something, mm-hmm. or sort of failing to have learned it so far. And I feel like if you look at children trying things, they don't seem to exhibit this. Like, they'll sort of happily play soccer really poorly, or like fail to get something and just kind of keep trying. And they don't seem to feel this distress of like, wow, I can't do this yet.
Yeah.
But if you put yourself in the same position as an adult, you're like, I tried closure for 4 hours and it wasn't right. So therefore, I'm just not meant for this. Like, I'll never get this. And it was too uncomfortable to continue.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like that. It's like that with any learning any new thing, right?
Yeah.
So I think if we remember that it takes a while and we have somebody tell us that it's okay, then it's like, oh, well, this is expected. I'm not supposed to get it right away. It's
right.
All right.
Yeah.
So
can you, what do the exercises look like?
So it's broken into a few parts.
Mm-hmm.
The first few weeks are doing a selection of foreclosure exercises.
Yep.
And I don't know if you're familiar with the website.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it's a fantastic project. So you can do little exercises that kind of give you the answer, and then you have to make the test pass,
right?
But online.
Yep.
So it's working through a few of those a day, and they get progressively harder.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a few weeks of that, then moving on to some katas, I made a GitHub site called Wonderland Katas. So they're inspired by Alice in Wonderland, because the book also has kind of a theme of Alice in Wonderland.
Yep. Okay.
going through it. And Lewis Carroll was also a great puzzle person. He loved puzzles and mm-hmm. word puzzles. So they're a selection of that as well.
Nice. Very cool. And I heard that one of the things you recommend is like getting involved in the community in some way, like integrating yourself a bit.
Yes, yes. I think that's really key to surrounding yourself with other people that are learning and building things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost like if you're learning French,
yeah.
to go over to France and just kind of immerse yourself. But I think that was key for me,
mm-hmm.
getting involved. Actually, my first open source project was the foreclosure. So I have to give it to those guys. They made it a really welcoming first project
uh-huh.
for me to contribute on, and that kind of propelled me into getting more involved with the community and contributing and building other things and sharing with others.
That's so important. It's amazing how like that first project going well probably had a lot of impact on you staying in the community versus being like, this isn't for me.
It did. And having a friendly and welcoming attitude really... really, really helped.
Absolutely. That's huge.
So thank you, all of you, for closure people out there.
And that's a great site, by the way, if you're looking to pick up closure. It's like a bunch of online problems, and you type in a text field in your browser and it tells you if the test passed or not. And then you get to see other people's solutions, which is mm-hmm. often the best part for me, was I would spend, 40 minutes writing an implementation of something, and then someone else's solution is just laughably shorter than mine.
Yeah.
It just happened over and over again.
But warning, it's addictive. Sometimes when you start, you just can't stop.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. So you are a closure fan.
I am.
I'd love to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So as I said, I studied physics in college, so I never really took any computer science courses.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really tell whether I fell in love with Lisp or I fell in love with closure.
Right.
But I love the whole prints,
mm-hmm.
the whole print thing, and the forms, and just how I love everything about it. So, and then closure, I'll of course you have the practicality of it as well, and the interop and the concurrency. So,
yep,
that doesn't hurt.
Yeah, yeah. So you wrote a blog post called "The Hitchhiker's Guide to Closure." That handles a thing I hear about closure a lot, and the best way that I've heard so far, which is you say like, imagine that you have like the Hitchhiker's Guide to Closure, and on the front, as opposed to saying "Don't panic," it says "Don't worry about the parens."
Exactly.
Which is such the right message. You hear that from people all the time, like, I tried closure, but and it's like, no, it's just not a thing. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I like it.
That was actually kind of fun, because I was on a Douglas Adams kick.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started writing like Douglas Adams closure fan fiction, which I think is a new genre as far as I know.
Probably. Gotta imagine.
So, some people are really put off by the parens, and I guess what I can say to them is it really, after you start working in it, it just goes away. You just kind of stop seeing it like mm-hmm. that, especially if you have a good editor or that uses Pear Edit.
Mm-hmm.
And that automatically matches up the prints for you and sorts them at the right level. I would actually much really prefer that over like a white space language. So,
yep. It has some nice advantages that are kind of hard to appreciate until you've been using it for a little while.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So what is it about Clojure that you like? What drew you to it, and what keeps you there?
Well, I think it, first and foremost, it's the simplicity of it. Mm-hmm. The simplicity of the syntax, how you always have like the function in the first place. And, you know, it's just very beautiful in its elegance. And then, I mean, the whole practicality of it, mm-hmm. that you can do things with it. You can build things, it performs, you can do concurrency with it. And that's great too. Mm-hmm. And then also the community is just fabulous. Mm. I have so many smart and creative and fun and nice people,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, that is important.
Oh, sure. Us. Yeah, absolutely.
And being part of a community where just new and exciting things are happening every day is really invigorating.
Yeah. It feels like a lot of innovation is happening in the Clojure world.
It is. It is, both on the back end and the front end.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was interesting to me. I started really paying attention to it because I noticed a lot of Rubyists that I respected a lot and thought of as being like sort of very smart and forward thinking and all that, sort of leaving Ruby and going to Clojure.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that might mean something.
True, very
check
true.
Into this.
Yep. Yeah, that is a trend.
Yeah, it feels like the state of the art is being pushed forward more in the Clojure world than a lot of other languages, actually, to me.
Yeah, I think it is a theme because they're looking around in the core language and borrowing ideas from other languages. I mean, right. Like Go groups and
totally. And what I actually love that. I like that Clojure looked at Go and said, you know what, that actually is, that's how we should do it too. And they not we don't yeah. have to do something different just because another language has done this mm-hmm. already.
Yeah, yeah.
That I think says a lot, actually.
Yeah, and the work that David Nolan and the Clojure script community is doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't even keep up with all that. It's just so fantastic.
Have you gotten a chance to use Clojure script much?
I have used it a little bit. I'm not, I've primarily been working on backend stuff, but yep. The ability to have some of the same beautiful syntax and feeling like you have Clojure on the front end and the back end, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a great thing.
Totally.
I mean, just being able to work in one language.
Mm-hmm. Did you come to Clojure? You used to do Java, right?
I did. I did. I started out doing Java and then I kind of moved to Ruby.
Okay.
And then from Ruby went to Clojure.
Yeah. So what was your experience of moving from an OO to a functional language?
So it took me a while,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I think I really kind of have the functional mindset now, having worked in it for quite a while. But I can see myself going back when I try to get myself back in the OO mindset. Mm-hmm. For example, the other day, I was doing some JavaScript and just having to do a loop and then mutate something in the loop. And I was like, how does this even work? I don't even understand what this is.
Yep.
So it is totally a different mindset. And your mind gets rusty when you're not used to thinking that way.
Sure, sure. Is there anything you'd remove from Clojure? Do you think it has any warts that you would love to see, you know, pulled off or changed in some way?
I'm pretty much a fangirl.
Yeah.
So. I don't need to say too much, but I mean, something that everybody can kind of agree on is the error messages.
Well,
I mean.
Sure. Yeah. 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 So. It's funny how that shows up in the survey every year, like worst part of Clojure. Everyone just consistently says that.
Yeah. So, yeah. But you know, Java has a lot to do with that. So.
Sure. Yep. So I was reading on one of the posts from your blog and you talk about the transition of working from home mm-hmm. as being something that can be tough. But you mentioned that pairing a lot really helps with that.
Yeah. So when I first started my remote job, I was a little bit worried because I really like working with people
mm-hmm.
and learning from people and being energized by that. And I was afraid that just me sitting alone with my code day after day would weigh on me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I found doing some pairing while you're developing code is just like really being in the office with someone and sitting next to them. Generally, I have two monitors going, and then I have one monitor that's using Skype or HipChat or whatever the chat thing is, and video conferencing. And then it has all your communications on it. And then the other monitor has a code. So it is really like you're just sitting there and being able to talk to somebody and develop on code, and you can share and collaborate on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing is then you're in the comfort of your own home. You have your setup exactly the way that you like it. If you want it really warm in your room, you don't have to worry if the other person's too hot. You know, you can totally be comfortable in your environment.
Yeah.
And of course, you can pair with people anywhere. You don't have to worry about geography. You don't have to worry about car traffic or anything. So it's nice.
What percentage of time would you pair if it were up to you?
For me, I like pairing pretty much. I would say 80% to 90%. I mean, there's some things that it doesn't – I'm not dogmatic in it. So there's some things that it doesn't make sense to pair on. For example, if it's just really nothing to discuss on it, if you're just, you know, doing some code tweaking or, you know, CSS or something like that, there might not be huge value in it. But anything that you're building, I think that – I actually produce better code collaboratively than solo.
Yep.
And that's not to say that I don't like working solo. I do like working solo. I like getting in my own zone and doing my own things. But as far as the end result for the client, I think code produced by more than one person on the whole tends to be better.
Same. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'm curious, what would you recommend to people that don't pair a lot on how to be good at pairing? How do you be a good pair?
Well, it's a skill.
Yeah.
Like anything else.
Yeah.
And when I first started pairing, it was really draining to pair constantly throughout the day. But I think taking turns, we've kind of gotten into when I'm in a good pairing situation, cadence, we'll have somebody, usually have somebody that's really the active driver or the active coder. And then somebody that's more passive, kind of looking at the bigger picture and making sure you don't get stuck in rabbit holes. So changing that, maybe at lunchtime, you know, pushing to a branch and then switching drivers. That seemed to work pretty well for us. I mean, just being a good listener.
Yeah.
I think is a good skill too.
Yeah. I think the social stuff is the hard part actually.
Yeah.
The mechanics is kind of the easy part. It's how do you offer feedback in a way that it's going to be accepted by somebody and not going to be taken in an insulted way, and things like that are the tricky bits.
Yeah. But when it's done right, it really helps. It helps not only the code, but helps build both people's skills.
For sure. Yeah. That's amazing for that. I mean, I think some of the best moments in my development as a programmer have been pairing with people that are better than I am or have different skills than I do.
Oh yeah.
And that's the wonderful thing is like no two people that have the exact same set of skills. So you can pair with basically anyone and you will learn something over, you know, the course of an hour or two, at least one thing.
Yes, which I love. Definitely.
Especially if you're pairing with people that are passionate about like environment or, you know, editor shortcuts or things like that. Like that's great.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I've enjoyed, because I usually use Emacs, but I like pairing with somebody that is like a Vim wizard or, you know, some other editor, IntelliJ, then I'm like, wow, I didn't know that your editor could do that. That's really cool.
Yep. You know? That's a very good attitude to have. That can be hard to develop. Like for me, when you're very used to your environment, you know, if you go somewhere else where you're completely unaccustomed, it's tough to give up that feeling of power and control. But it seems like you've managed it.
I got a pretty open mind.
That's good. You mentioned earlier the impact of you had a physics professor that you was really important to you. Yeah. Do you have any other examples of role models impacting the way your life has gone in a big way?
Oh yeah. Well, I was fortunate enough to work for a while with Jim Wyrick.
Oh, nice.
And he was just a fantastic role model. I mean, he was not only a fantastic developer and teacher, but just a wonderful person. So I've learned so much from him, or just being around him for the years that I was. So the way he taught people, the way he did presentations, the way that he'd pair, and just the way that he was just kind to everybody.
Yeah.
And shared his love of programming, and you know, it inspired so many people. So he is definitely one of my role models.
Yeah. Was the kindness, you think, the important thing there?
It was definitely core to who he was.
Yeah.
So I just share a little story of shortly after he passed away in our office, I had all sorts of people coming up to me expressing condolences from the other offices that I had never met.
Mm.
And, you know, in particular, the cleaning people, everyone he met, he was just super kind to. He'd show him what he was doing. He was into drones. He would, if you're walking down the hallway, you'd see him just random people showing him how to program the drones and having him fly them around.
Mm-hmm.
He was just such a kind and open person. And he didn't care whether you were a really expert in your field at programming. He would talk to you about that. But if he didn't know programming at all either, he would equally just talk to you and share his enthusiasms.
So. Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned drones. You're into that yourself a bit.
Yeah. So Jim and I got into it kind of in the same time. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of fun with the Parrot AR drones.
Yeah.
So he wrote a control library in Ruby, and then I was sitting next to him, and I wrote a control library in Clojure.
Nice.
So then
who finished first?
Well, he did, of course. Yeah. So, but then we'd fly him around together and mm-hmm. had quite a lot of fun.
Yeah. Are you still playing around with AI and robots and all that?
I do whenever I get some spare time. I've been kind of crunched in time lately, but mm-hmm. I have my robots sitting under my desk right now.
Okay.
And I have one thing that I've gotten that I've been waiting for the warmer weather to experiment with,
mm-hmm.
and it shoots fire.
Ah.
So it's one of these magic things, and I haven't tried it, but it's like a wrist device, and it's flash paper. I guess I've never used flash paper,
okay.
but I guess
yep.
people are familiar. But flash paper for like magic shows.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking if I could hook this device up to one of my robots, like a Roomba or something, I'd have like a
fire breathing robot.
Yeah,
that's
I'd have a fire robot upgrade, but I haven't done that yet.
This is interesting. I'm always on the lookout for weird things to do during conference talks to wake people mm-hmm. up. I think shooting fire out of anything would be a pretty good,
exactly.
pretty good tactic.
Exactly. But I can't really practice in the house,
yeah.
so I need to wait till the warmer weather to go.
Where are you?
Outside somewhere. I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay, gotcha. Do you still have snow?
No, it just melted, and it's warm, and the grass is growing,
beautiful.
And the chickens are happy. So I have some chickens.
Oh, great! Mm-hmm. Do you get eggs from them?
I do.
Nice. I'm jealous of that. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So it's fun. So yeah, I'm looking forward to, I'm going to Clojure West in a couple weeks, and there's a talk on using Clojure to protect your flock from raccoons. And I'm super excited about that talk because it addresses a real problem
yeah.
that I have.
Right. That talk is targeted right at you.
Exactly.
That's perfect.
Exactly.
Very cool. Is there anything else that we should cover? We could talk about the cheese shop you want to open someday.
Oh, yeah. I do love cheese. I went on a trip to England and France quite a number of years ago with my husband, and I had never seen a whole shop dedicated to cheese. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were like cheese all in the windows and just everywhere, and I was just so my eyes were just as big as dish plates, and I was just pressed up against the glass.
Yep.
So it was just amazing to me. So
it's like coming home to a homeland you didn't even know you had your
exactly.
whole life.
So I'm very impressed. England and France, all your cheese is great.
Well done, English and French listeners.
Yes.
Good stuff. Awesome. Cool. Well, why don't we leave it there then?
Okay. Great.
Awesome. It was nice talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
Talking with you too.
Yeah. So your book is called Living Clojure.
That's correct.
It's coming out soon.
Soon, yes.
Soonish. So go buy it if you're interested in Clojure, particularly if you're interested in a nice 7-week on-ramp into the language and becoming a functional programmer yourself. Today's show was produced and edited by Tom Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/143. Thanks for listening.